Ali Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we love bringing you stories that we think you may know, but you don't truly know. What's the story behind the story? And what's the story the media hasn't told you? Today we're going to bring you such a story that's brought to us by our sponsor, Hillsdale College. Generally, we do This Days in History with Hillsdale. But this story was just so good. And it came from a speech delivered there by the former executive editor at Sports Illustrated and author Charles Lerson. And it's on his book, Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty, about a figure in sports history who is widely known as an all-time great player, but who is also widely known for being a not-so-great man. But it was the knowledge of Charles's friends that really scared him.
After asking around a bit in my neighborhood in Brooklyn, New York, and conducting a highly unscientific poll of friends and relatives and acquaintances scattered about the globe, I came to the conclusion that there were an awful lot of people who had no thoughts or opinion about Ty Cobb, one way or the other, and for a very good reason. They had no idea who he was. An athlete, a few in this group guessed rather feebly, but just as many thought he was the guy who invented the Cobb salad. And most of the people just hated me for asking them a question they didn't know the answer to. Or they hated me more than they had before. Their reaction, this ignorance, frightened me. I mean, it sent a shiver down my spine and into my wallet. I mean, I do this for a living. And think about it. Before too long, I would be out there peddling a book, promising to tell you everything you wanted to know about someone you probably never heard of. This is not a recipe for success. So that was the first school of thought, or non-school of thought, or school of non-thought. And to me, it was a distressingly large one. But it wasn't the biggest.
No, it wasn't. Thankfully for Charles, but not so much for Ty Cobb's legacy. His friends are only one slice of America.
The biggest group by far, I sense, consisted of people who had very definitely had heard of Ty Cobb, but who thought of him in negative terms, not just as a sourpuss or even a serious misanthrope, but as one of the worst human beings who ever lived. To them, he was an undeniably great player, a king of the so-called dead ball era. I should say here that Ty Cobb played in the major leagues from 1905 to 1928, all but two of those years for the Detroit Tigers. And he was a superstar, the first man voted into the Hall of Fame. His lifetime batting average, 366 over 23 and a half seasons, is amazing and still the highest of all time. These people in the second group knew all that, but they would tell you that Cobb, for all his talent, was a racist bastard and a mean spike-sharpening son of a bitch. I sound like Kurt Schilling now, don't I? Who thought nothing of injuring his fellow players just to gain another base or score a run. Everyone hated him, the members of this group would say. Indeed, quite a few people I encountered early and even late in my research process described Cobb as a murderer. Some braided together the racist and murderer motifs and asked if I was going to write about the time Cobb stabbed to death a black waiter in Cleveland just because the young man was acting uppity.
Well, that's something. That's a story. And this is the guy Charles wanted to write about?
The people in this group fervently believed the basic theme of evil, and it was easy to see why. They'd been told that Cobb was a bad man over and over all of their lives. The sheer repetition was impressive to them. The repetition felt like evidence. And they were told over and over about Cobb's depravity by people they respected, told very often by their daddies, who passed down to them all the sacred baseball lore, the things you needed to know to be a well-rounded person in the world. They also read about the bad Cobb in articles and books. In one such book, written by a man named Al Stump, it was said that when little children wrote to Cobb asking for an autographed picture or baseball advice, he steamed the penny stamps off the return envelopes and kept them for himself and never wrote back. In another book, this one about Ty Cobb's contemporary Trespeaker, a respected baseball historian named Timothy Gay wrote that Ty Cobb could not abide the sight of a black person walking down the street. Gay said that he, Cobb, would pistol whip any African-American he saw on the sidewalk. And then, of course, there were the stories about how Ty Cobb sharpened his spikes. Before every game, Cobb, it was written in several books and many articles, would sit in the dugout, sometimes it was sit on top of the dugout, honing his cleats with a large file and cackling maniacally.
Learson goes on to reveal that he was also a part of this school of thought about Cobb and set out to write his book to prove that group right, which affected his thoughts when visiting Cobb's boyhood home and final resting place in Royston, Georgia.
There was a weathered pine wreath, a plastic pink lily, and a few baseballs stuck behind the grating in front of the door. How pathetic, I thought. Scene fit for a villain. I pressed my forehead on the warm glass window and peered inside. Cobb and his spinster sister were on one side, and their parents were on the other. Very tidy, I thought, just as you might expect, though I would have thought the same thing if it had been messy in there. I had predisposition towards believing Cobb was evil, remember, and so whatever I saw would have confirmed my opinion. You know how they say that your hair and your fingernails continue to grow after you die? As I slid squinting through that window, I imagined Cobb lying there in a kind of Howard Hughesian dishabille, his hair and his fingernails filling the casket like excelsior, the shrinking flesh pulling back his mouth into a hideous zombie grin. I was scaring myself a bit, creating a little horror movie in my head, and it was fun.
And when we come back, you're going to hear the flip side, because, oh my goodness, what he discovers is so much of what he thought he knew about Cobb was a myth. Anyone who saw the movie with Lee J. Cobb and Robert Wool, my goodness, what a monster this man is depicted as. And that's what we do here on Our American Stories, tell you the story behind the story. When we come back, the professor explains the other side of the Ty Cobb story. More after these messages. Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, the life of Ty Cobb, and a speech at Hillsdale College, our proud sponsors. And Hillsdale College is a great place to study all the things that matter in life, art, history, the finer things. And it's a classic liberal arts education. If you can't get to Hillsdale, Hillsdale can come to you. Go to hillsdale.edu. Their great online courses are available for all of you to see, and it's absolutely free. And this speech that was given at Hillsdale College about Ty Cobb by a former executive editor at Sports Illustrated, author Charles Learson, and his book Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty, is all about the myth of Ty Cobb as opposed to the reality, and the myth that we all thought we knew, thanks to the movie, a couple of books, Monster. Monster with God-given talent. Boy, who doesn't want to buy that story? Now let's hear the other side of the story. But then Learson started doing what writers are supposed to do. Get collaboration, do research, talk to folks. And this wasn't exactly groundbreaking research. It was just simple. Take a listen.
But what about that Cobb's 19th century Southern roots? How could someone born in Georgia in 1886 not be kind of racist? I'll tell you what I found out, not because I'm a genius or the Babe Ruth of researchers, but because I use the methods and standards that would apply to any conventional history book. Ty Cobb, it turned out, descended from a long line of abolitionists. His great-grandfather was a minister who preached against slavery and was run out of town for his troubles. His grandfather was the equivalent of a conscientious objector who refused to fight in the Confederate Army because of the slavery issue. and his father was an educator and state senator who spoke out for his black constituents and had a very short political career as a result, and once broke up a lynch mob in town.
Yeah, and by the way, having been a transplanted Yankee now living in the South, nothing sickens me more than the assumptions of people outside of the South about Southerners. And it's despicable. It's despicable. And here you see it, evidence right up front. This was one of the big myths of Cobb, racist. Of course, he's from Georgia. That's why. Next, on the top of Cobb's family's activism against racism, Ty himself. Well, he took a clear stance.
Cobb himself was never asked about racism and segregation until 1952, when the Texas League was finally integrating, and the Sporting News asked him what he thought. "The Negro should be accepted wholeheartedly and not grudgingly," he said. "The Negro has the right to play professional baseball, and who's to say he has not?" Other ballplayers and ex-ballplayers were keeping mum on the topic or saying they didn't think mixed-race baseball was a good idea. Cobb, though Southern, was saying accepted wholeheartedly and not grudgingly. By then, he'd attended many Negro League games, sometimes throwing out the first ball and often sitting in the dugout with the players. He said that Willie Mays was the only modern-day player he'd pay to see, and that Roy Campanella, another black man, was the player who reminded him most of himself.
How about that? Not in the movie. Remember we did the Johnny Cash Hour? All the stuff that wasn't in the movie about Cash's Christian faith? It was nasty. How over the top they went, how out of their way they went to eliminate that part of Cash's life. And this is just straight nasty. Because all he had to do was read an old sports magazine to do the research. 1952, taking that stand makes you a Courage Award winner. Oh, except you're from Georgia, so how could that be? And then there was the myth we got a laugh out of earlier concerning fan letters from children.
And did he really steal stamps from little children? Letters in museums and private collections showed that Cobb did in fact respond to his young fans, sometimes with handwritten letters that ran to 5 pages. He would often apologize for sending 2 or 3 autographed photos when the writer had asked only for one. And he always told the kids and adults who wrote to him that he was honored by their request for his autograph.
You can just wonder, how did this happen? How did this happen? And what about Cobb's alleged spiking of other players with his cleats? This one I heard more than any other from anybody. And there's that picture, that infamous picture that we've all seen. What did Cobb's opponents actually think about him and this?
He believed very strongly that the runner had the right of way in what he called my little patch right in front of the bag. If the fielder wanted to put his leg or his hands in that danger zone, that was, as they said in those days, on his watch. The other players I found respected Cobb's ability and his consistency and agreed with the little patch theory. "It was no fun putting the ball on Cobb when he came slashing into the plate," said Wally Shang, an American League catcher. "But he never cut me up. He was too pretty a slider to hurt anyone who put the ball on him right." Cobb's teammate, infielder Germany Schaefer, said, "Ty Cobb is a game square fellow who never cut a man with his spikes intentionally in his life, and anyone who gets by with his spikes knows it." The general theme of the ballplayer appraisals was that the civilians may think that Cobb uses his spikes too much, but we, the men who play the game, know better. And if Cobb could dish out the punishment and the intimidation, he could also take it. Steve O'Neill of the Cleveland Naps once favored Cobb with the greatest compliment a catcher can give. "He came home on a base hit and was blocking the plate. And I was blocking the plate," O'Neill said. "I got him in the kidneys and knocked him out. When he came to, he didn't say a word. He just got up and limped back to his position."
And there you have it. No double standard for Cobb. That patch of earth rule applied to him and everyone else. And there was mutual respect about it. So how did the Cobb we know as a monster, how did that happen in the first place? A really good question if you look at all the facts and research Learson did. One that can be answered by the passage of time. A journalist named Al Stump, who practiced sensationalism in writing an autobiography about Cobb, and the repetition of these myths, including a movie that Cobb's biographer Al Stump wrote himself with Ron Shelton, and the repetition of these myths until everyone assumes they're the facts.
What I didn't understand until I undertook this project was the power of repetition to mold minds. In some cases, repetition may be stronger than truth. You know how I said earlier that your hair and fingernails continue to grow after your death? That's not true. And the fact that we've heard it a million times doesn't make it so. In Cobb's case, people were entertained and flattered by the myth of evil that was created by this scandalmonger named Al Stump. So they repeated it, and they became impressed by the sound of their own echoing voice. And that's a shame, because along the way, a man's reputation was destroyed, and a very good story, a reality that is more interesting than the myth, was obliterated. I didn't set out to right any wrongs or clean up Cobb's reputation. Indeed, as I've told you, I originally set out to soil it some more. But in trying to start from scratch and tell the story of a man's life, I wound up with a biography that, for better or worse, comes with a message, at least for those people in that large and avid second group who believe the myth of the evil Cobb. And the message is simply this: stop talking for a minute and listen, because there's a lot of evidence to the contrary.
Now, Cobb, however, could still be considered a monster, but a monster of a more legitimate kind.
When Cobb made it to first, which he did more than anyone else, he batted over 400 in three seasons, the fun had just begun. Cobb understood the rhythms and the protocols of the game, and he constantly fooled around with them, keeping everyone nervous and off balance. He played what the sports writers then called psychological baseball, though he often appeared to be in need of a psych ward himself. His stated intention was to be a mental hazard for the opposition, and he did this by hopping around in the batter's box, constantly changing his stance as the pitcher released the ball, and then when he got on base, hopping around some more, chattering, making false starts, limping around and feigning injury, and running at precisely the wrong moment when you'd least expect it. He still holds the record for stealing home, perhaps the most exciting play in all of baseball and rarely seen today. He did it 54 times. Think about it. Ty Cobb once stole second, third, and home on three consecutive pitches. He once turned a tap back to the pitcher's mound into an inside-the-park home run, and he didn't even slide.
Amazing. Again, not in the movie. Not in the movie. Now, Ty Cobb wasn't great at everything he did. He was a human being after all.
I came across a curious piece written in late 1911 after the baseball season when Cobb was touring in a play, a three-act comedy called The College Widow. In those days when ballplayers were tied to their teams by means of something called the reserve clause and could never become free agents and sell their services at their true market value and therefore were often making less than the people watching them in the stands, they often capitalized on their fame in the offseason by appearing in plays or in vaudeville. Cobb was not an especially good actor, but it became immediately apparent to me as I read the story in the Atlanta Constitution, which was an account of a backstage visit with him, that it worried him that he wasn't a very good actor because he wanted very much to please the audience.
And there you have it. And again, Charles Learson, this is Hillsdale College, quite a speech. And it just shows you the power of an author. One of my heroes, Bobby Knight, one of the great coaches and one of the great men, gets a visit from a journalist, John Feinstein, in 1985. The book, A Season on the Brink, a pack of lies about a great man, a journalist wanting to do something, gain ownership, do something nasty to a great man. Be wary of what you read. Thank you, Hillsdale College, for this terrific story, Myth versus Reality, The Life of Ty Cobb. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And from time to time, we like to drill down deep on a book. And the book we're now about to complete is the book our team chose called Foolproof: Why Safety Can Be Dangerous and How Danger Makes Us Safe. And joining us for our final installment is Greg Ipp, the Wall Street Journal's chief economics commentator. Greg, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to talk to you, Lee.
We're on to chapter 11, the final chapter, which is titled A Foolproofer's Handbook: How to Make the Most of Our Best Instincts. And I wanted to get to that first, because when we had started this, we talked about instincts and we talked about how do we make our kids safe for this world? How do we give them the instincts to assess danger or not? And if we protect them too much, we then throw them into the world without this ability to discern. So let's start with instincts themselves. And why did you start with this to end your book?
Because you're exactly right, Lee. I think that every parent understands this tension, that they want their child to grow up safe, but they also want them to learn to explore and to have adventures. And so that's why every day of being a parent is a trade-off, right? We don't save our toddlers from every single fall, but we also don't let them run out between cars. We want them to fall often enough that they learn to walk, but we don't want them to take those risks that could actually seriously harm them. And the point that I make in my book is that this kind of tension suffuses us all the time as a civilization. And in my book, I draw a distinction between the people among us who are engineers, who think that we have all this knowledge and science and ability. We can design every bit of our environment, whether it's the financial system or our flood defenses, to prevent any disaster from happening to us. But then there are other people who I call the ecologists, who say, you know, when you monkey around with the environment or the financial system, you actually create other risks and you leave us actually in more danger. And after I finished all the work I did researching this book, whether it was talking to people who handle forest fires or antibiotics and disease or finance, is that I realized that there is no easy answer, that we need both of these instincts. It's a very good thing that we try to make our world and our lives safer, whether it's from a recession or from a hurricane or from a disease. But we also mustn't go overboard and try too hard, because then we create these unintended consequences where we open ourselves up to other risks, where we actually become too complacent and therefore less resilient to the disasters that come along.
Indeed, and you write about this beautifully in the book. I'm going to read a paragraph. The engineers and the ecologists, in their different ways, embody the best of civilization. We do not have to side with either, but we can take the best of both. Our goal should be to eliminate big disasters, not small ones, to accept a bit more risk and instability today in return for more reward and stability in the long run. You know, one of my favorite books of, I think it's probably almost a decade ago, Max Boot, who is a regular contributor to Wall Street Journal, wrote a book called Small Wars of Peace.
Yeah.
And he was writing about something that said, look, if we get involved in some of these littler sort of boots on the ground, Marine Expeditionary Forces or Special Forces forays, we can then avoid some of the bigger disasters. And I think he was on to some of the same things you're on to here in some respect, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think the constant awareness of danger out there does actually impart a wariness and a care on our part that makes us safer. Let's talk a little bit about some of the things we actually can do to put the ideas into action that I've talked about and that you and I have talked about, Lee, over these last few weeks. For example, one of the things that engineers are trying to do is to build ever more elaborate defenses. So in flood control, for example, in this country for hundreds of years, we've responded to flooding on rivers like the lower Mississippi by building levees. And each year the levees get taller and bigger as the floods become larger. But you know, levees do eventually fail or they get overtopped. And so one of the ways you can deal with the risk of floods is not to build levees which fail, but to actually just allow space, you know, keep the floodplain clear. And then when the river floods, it doesn't flood homes and factories and businesses. It just floods empty land. In fact, that's one of the things the Army Corps of Engineers tried to do over the years, to actually maintain spillways in the lower Mississippi area so that they can actually blow up the levees and allow the water to flood where it doesn't do any harm. And that sort of need for space, I think, is very important for all of us to keep in mind. Driving, for example, it's great to have safety belts and anti-lock brakes and all those things, but the single best way to stay out of an accident is leave space around you from the other cars. I tell this story about how my wife and I were driving in France many years ago, and I saw a sign that translated in English said, speed makes everything worse. When you're driving faster, your accidents happen at higher impact, and that space that you have around you gets used up faster. Slow down a little bit, and you'd be amazed at how much safer that makes you.
Yeah, because it buys you a lot more space. You know, the first time I came under the understanding of this was George Will's column on anti-lock brakes. And it turned out that because people thought the car could brake faster, they were putting less space between themselves and the car in front of them, and they were going faster. And in the end, there turned out to be more accidents with this technology that it was actually designed to protect the very drivers. Talk about
right.
that.
Right. And I worry a little bit that if this craze for self-driving cars takes off, we're going to have a variant of the same problem. One of the things that people realize with self-driving cars is that the cars can drive closer together because the computer is better at stopping than the human being. But if you do that and something goes wrong with the computer, you just have less time to react and you might be more likely to have an accident.
And you can only hope that the computer will program that space into the DNA of the software. So that's taken into account. Greg, what did you leave out of the book that you'd wished you'd kept in, or that you stumbled upon later, or in conversations with people as you did interviews? Are there things that you wish you'd had in there?
I think that one of the things that I would probably address in more detail if I could would be what we as parents and ordinary people in our ordinary lives have to do to try and find the right balance between this engineering and this ecologist idea. Let me give you a good example of something that comes up in my own life as a commuter, as a parent, and as a researcher, which is a question of like riding a bicycle. Now, I know from research that motorcycle helmets are very valuable at preventing serious head injuries and motorcycle accidents. Now, so shouldn't the same be true of bicycle helmets, and therefore shouldn't we have helmets that require people, children especially, to wear bicycle helmets? Well, it actually is kind of complicated, because it's true that if you have an accident riding a bicycle and you're wearing a helmet, you are much less likely to have a serious head injury. But if you force people to wear bicycle helmets when they ride their bike, fewer people will ride bicycles. And if fewer people ride bicycles, they're not going to get the great cardiovascular benefits that they get from riding a bicycle. And another thing happens. You have fewer cyclists on the road. And when there's fewer cyclists on the road, drivers are less aware of them, and they tend to drive faster. And that actually puts the cyclists that are out there in greater danger. And there's a final thing, Lee. Even if we didn't take those things into consideration, riding a bicycle is one of the most wonderful, liberating experiences of growing up. I cannot express the joy I felt when I saw my kids being able to ride their bikes without training wheels. Now, let me assure you, they were wearing helmets when they did it, and whenever they go riding a bike, I make sure that they have helmets. But I would not insist that everybody, that every parent, require a helmet on their child to ride a bike, because there might be parents who can't afford that helmet or who don't want the helmet. And if they did that, they'd deny their children the wonderful freedom that comes with riding a bicycle. If you go to like the Netherlands, everybody that rides a bike, practically nobody wears a helmet, and they have very low levels of bicycle injury because the society is so aware of the presence of cyclists on the road, and drivers take care around the cyclists, and the cyclists drive carefully. And I think that this Netherlands is better off for it. That's a long way of saying is that we can't be too ideological, whether we're for helmets or against them, because, frankly, sometimes they're a good idea, as they are in, say, motorcycles, and sometimes they're not. So in every aspect of our daily lives, we have to try and weigh these competing considerations.
Well, Greg, thank you so much for joining us. The book is Foolproof: Why Safety Can Be Dangerous and How Danger Makes Us Safe. Greg Ipp is also the Wall Street Journal's chief economics commentator. Thanks, Greg, for taking all this time with us. And we look forward to many more meetings together.
It's been great talking with you, Lee. All the best.
You bet. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. To catch any of these interviews with Greg, go to OurAmericanNetwork.org. More after these messages. This is Our American Stories, and I'm Lee Habib. This day in history, brought to you as always by Hillsdale College, marks the passing of a legendary musician, Bob Marley. Here's Jesse Edwards with the story of an iconic musician that died far too young, at the age of just 36.
Born February 6, 1945 in St. Anne Parish, Jamaica, Bob Marley helped introduce reggae music to the world and remains one of the genre's most beloved artists to this day.
Don't worry about a thing. Every little thing gonna be all right.
The the son of a black teenage mother and an absent white father. He spent his early years in St. Anne Parish, in the village known as Nine Miles. Arriving in Kingston in the late 1950s, Marley lived in Trenchtown, one of the city's poorest neighborhoods.
One good thing about music, when it hits you, you know, whoa, whoa, I say one good thing about music, when it hits
you. He struggled in poverty, but he found inspiration in the music around him. Trenchtown had a number of successful local performers and was considered the Motown of Jamaica.
This is Trenchtown Rock. Don't watch that.
Sounds from the United States also drifted over in the radio and through jukeboxes. Marley was heavily influenced by artists such as Ray Charles, Elvis Presley, Fats Domino, and the Drifters.
This magic moment.
Marley devoted most of his time to music. Under the guidance of Joe Higgs, Marley worked on improving his singing abilities. He met another student of Higgs, Peter McClintosh, also known as Peter Tosh, who would play an important role in Marley's career. A local record producer, Leslie Kong, liked Marley's vocals and had him record a few singles, the first of which was Judge Not, released in 1962.
Don't you look at me so smug and say I'm going bad. Who are you to judge me and the life that I live? I know that I'm not perfect.
While Marley didn't fare well as a solo artist, he found some success joining forces with his friends. In 1963, Bob Marley, Bunny Livingston, and Peter Tosh formed the Wailing Wailers. Their first single, Simmer Down, went to the top of the Jamaican charts in January 1964. The group became quite popular in Jamaica, but they had difficulty making it financially. Marley went to the United States, where his mother was now living. After 8 months, Marley returned to Jamaica and reunited with his friends to form the Wailers. Around this time, Marley was exploring his spiritual side and developing a growing interest in the Rastafarian movement. Both religious and political, the Rastafarian movement began in Jamaica in the 1930s and drew its beliefs from many sources, including Jamaican nationalist Marcus Garvey, the Old Testament, and their African heritage and culture. For a time in the late 1960s, Bob Marley worked with pop singer Johnny Nash. Nash scored a worldwide hit with Marley's song, Stir It Up. The Wailers also worked with producer Lee Perry during this era. Some of their successful songs together were Trenchtown Rock, Soul Rebel, and 400 Years. The Wailers got their big break in 1972 when they landed a contract with Island Records, founded by Chris Blackwell. For the first time, the group hit the studios to record a full album. The result was the critically acclaimed Catch a Fire. To support the record, the Wailers toured Britain and the United States in 1973, performing as an opening act for both Bruce Springsteen and Sly and the Family Stone.
No sun will shine in my day today.
No sun will shine.
The high yellow moon won't come out to play.
That same year, the group released their second full album, Burnin', featuring the hit song I Shot the Sheriff. Rock legend Eric Clapton released a cover of the song in 1974, and it became a number one hit in the United States. In Britain, 1975, the Wailers scored their first top 40 hit with No Woman, No Cry.
Said I remember.
Already a much admired star in his native Jamaica, Bob Marley was on his way to becoming an international music icon. He made the U.S. music charts with the album Rastaman Vibration in 1976. One track in particular stands out as an expression of his devotion to his faith and the interest in political change, war.
Until the philosophy which owed one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Everywhere is war. It's a war.
Back in Jamaica, Marley continued to be seen as a supporter of the People's National Party, and his influence in his native land was seen as a threat to the PNP's rivals. This may have led to the assassination attempt on Bob Marley in 1976. A group of gunmen attacked Marley and the Wailers while they were rehearsing on the night of December 3rd, 1976, 2 days before a planned concert in Kingston's National Heroes Park. One bullet struck Marley in the sternum and one in the bicep. Another hit his wife, Rita, in the head. Fortunately, the Marleys were not severely injured, but their manager, Don Taylor, was not as fortunate. Shot 5 times, Taylor had to undergo surgery to save his life. Despite the attack, and after much deliberation, Bob Marley still played at that show. The motivation behind the attack was never uncovered, and Marley fled the country a day after the concert. Now living in London, England, Bob Marley went on to work on the album Exodus, which was released in 1977. The title track draws an analogy between the biblical story of Moses and the Israelites leaving exile in his own situation. Released as a single, Exodus was a hit in Britain. The entire album stayed on the UK charts for more than a year. Today, Exodus is considered one of the best albums ever made. Marley had a health scare in 1977. He sought treatment in July of a toe he had injured earlier that year. After discovering cancerous cells in his toe, doctors suggested amputation. Marley refused to have the surgery because his religious beliefs prohibited amputation. While working on the album Exodus, Marley and the Wailers recorded songs that were later released on the album Kaya in 1978. With love as its theme, the work featured 2 hits, Satisfy My Soul and Is This Love?
I wanna love you and treat you right. I wanna love you every day and every night.
Also in 1978, Marley returned to Jamaica to perform his One Love Peace concert, where he got Prime Minister Michael Manley of the PNP and opposition leader Edward Seaga of the JLP to shake hands on stage. A huge international success, the album Uprising, released 1980, featured Could You Be Loved and Redemption Song. Known for its poetic lyrics and social and political importance, the pared-down, folk-sounding Redemption Song was an illustration of Marley's talents as a songwriter.
Old pirates, yes, they rabbi, sold I to the merchant ships, minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly.
On tour to support that album, Bob Marley and the Wailers traveled throughout Europe. They also planned a series of concerts in the United States, but the group would only play 3 concerts there, 2 at Madison Square Garden in New York City and 1 performance at the Stanley Theater in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, before Marley became ill. The cancer, discovered earlier in his toe, had spread throughout his entire body.
Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds.
It soon became clear that Marley didn't have much longer to live, however, so the musician set out to return to his beloved Jamaica one last time. Sadly, Bob Marley would not manage to complete that journey, dying in Miami, Florida, May 11th, 1981. Adored by the people of Jamaica, Marley was given a hero send-off. More than 30,000 people paid their respects to the musician during his memorial service held at the National Arena in Kingston, Jamaica.
These songs of freedom.
Bob Marley achieved several great accomplishments during his lifetime, including serving as a world ambassador for reggae music, earning an induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1994, and selling more than an estimated 300 million albums to date, making him the first international superstar to emerge from the so-called Third World. This day in history, the world lost a living legend.
This is Our American Stories, the life of Bob Marley. This day in history, brought to you as always by Hillsdale College. More after these messages. Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And now and again, we like to hear from Greg Hengler, who does such a great job producing so many of our pieces, but you don't hear him a lot. And that's because he's thinking, he's brewing, he's stewing. And that leads us to today's Hengler's Rant. And Greg, what's on your mind this week?
Well, the topic I'm going to talk about today came about because my wife coaches volleyball. And in the middle of her game, she finally turned to her bench and she relayed this story to me after the game. And because everyone was yelling on the bench, and she turned to her players and she said, "Okay, you guys, how many of you get excited or do better when somebody yells, 'Come on, you guys!'" And nobody raised their hands. And she said, "Okay, can we agree that, you know, we can stop saying that?" And basically, I thought about that. And I thought, I've heard that millions of times my whole life, whether it's been from the crowd, from the parents in the stands, or from the bench yelling it during the game. And I was thinking that applies down the line. And all these chants that come from the bench or from the stands, I would have to say are 99% of them are absolutely worthless at best and discouraging at worst. And let me give you a couple samples, because what I started to do during the game was take notes whenever I heard somebody do one of these worthless chants, and every single thing that came out of their mouth was worthless. So I stood there with my phone and started taking them down. So here's the samples I got. "Come on, you guys, dig deep. Let's go. We can do it. Nice try. Here we go. Come on. Be aggressive. Be positive. Focus. We gotta want it more. Let's fight. Let's go. Keep it up. Come on, you guys. Bear down. Get hungry. Get angry, you guys. Let's pick it up. Don't quit. Hustle out there. Come on, girls. Let's go, boys." Okay? And you guys all recognize this. And I want to say, think about the things that you yell from the stands, parents, and what you yell from the bench, teammates. What these have in common is they're all worthless generalizations. And now I'm not saying that you need to make a comment that's results-based, meaning, you know, if somebody, you can't say anything until somebody scores a goal or makes a point or a hit. What it needs to be is merit-based, and it needs to be specific. So instead of saying, you know, "Hustle out there," you say, "Great hustle, Johnny." And everything that can be complimented, trust me, it is best done one-on-one. Yeah, there's that moment where you want to say it, but you're not going to scream it out. "It's nice job, Johnny. Good hustle." Or if somebody's batting and they normally stand there and they're too afraid to swing the bat and finally get the courage and they do swing the bat, hey, that's worth a compliment. You don't have to yell it out, but that's probably the only compliment you should have during the whole game. The rest of it, save up to walking up to the player and say, "Hey, that was a great slide," or whatever. Other than that, just keep your remarks to yourself, and the game will be much better for you and the players.
I'm pretty much on that. I think, yeah. I'm with you. Anybody here have a problem with that?
Hey, bada, 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 swing, bada. Hey, bada, 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 swing, bada. Kennedy, 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 swing, bada.
I take it one step further. I went to my little girl's baseball game, softball game, and there's just running commentary. The entire game, the audience is talking to the kids. I mean, it's just they're just talking to them all the time. Just shut up. If you got a parent, if you got a kid out there, just shut up. You shouldn't be even allowed to speak.
No.
Just shut up.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear your great job, Jenny. One more pitch. It's every, I mean, I there's one poor girl. The parents just didn't, I almost wanted to hit the guy. She just would not shut up. The poor girl just wanted to hide.
The clap is a great invention.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I was blessed to grow up and my parents didn't say a darn thing. My dad, he would coach. And he just sat in the corner, you know. He had a lot to say when I grew up playing hockey my whole life, and I had an ice rink in my backyard that my mom and dad built. And he was out there drilling me, and he had a lot to say. But game time, not a whisper.
Right, let him play. Yeah. Let him play. By the way, Coach Wooden was like that, too. We learned about that from Pat Williams, that he wasn't a screamer. All these guys up and down on the court now, the basketball coaches particularly, if you ever watch them, they're up all the time. They're on the court. They're running up and down. They're screaming. They're yelling. They're yelling at the refs. They're yelling at the players. I said, hey, why don't you try coaching? Like, if you coached, you could actually sit down and they could play. It's really crazy. I mean, 30 years ago, none of these coaches got up. Only a couple did. And now every single, now they're even wearing sneakers because they're up so much, it looks like they're actually going to join the game and play.
You can always try a little tough love, too. Like, don't screw it up, you little moron! Get your hands out of your pockets!
And I got to add a footnote to that based on your coach comment. Casey also made this point to me because she's assisted a lot of coaches, and I have to say that, you know, playing a lot of sports my whole life, I notice this too. When there's a timeout called or there's that, you know, in between the periods or whatever, when the coach, a lot of the times these coaches really don't have anything to say.
No.
And you all, let me listen, all you young guys out there and all you parents, if you want to listen into what your coaches are saying, you can tell if the coach is good, if they have actually something to say other than, come on, you guys, let's dig deep. Come on, you know, the cliches I just mentioned, because 90%+ of these coaches are going to use that as their default. And that means you have nothing to say. Get out of there. You should say nothing.
Yeah, well, you know this about acting coaches, or any good coaching is specific and it's individual or it's useless. Yeah. It's like, well, what are you going to say when an acting troupe is out there? Focus.
Yeah.
Concentrate. Yeah. No, I mean, it's got to be to the specific actor and it's got to be a specific instruction for actually a specific scene. Because what you give, the coaching advice you give for one scene doesn't apply to another scene. Yeah. Hengler is always not passionate enough. We're trying to open him up, folks. We're trying to get him to just, you know, be himself. And you got any ideas about the next rant? Because I know you're planting them in your head.
Yeah, I think I have one. And
don't do the rant. Just let us know what the rant is.
I won't do the rant, but I think this is what I'm going to touch on. And it's this idea that stay-at-home moms are really not working, that the people who go to a job are the ones that are working.
That's a good one. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, Hengler's Rant. And if you got one of your own, well, we'd love to hear it. And pretty soon we'll be opening up a line just for rants, because we know you've got them, folks. We know. And they've got to be ordinary things in life that we all experience. That's the key. Again, this is Lee Habib. This is Our American Story. Hengler. Hengler, Hengler. More Hengler. More cowbell. More after this. Yeah. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we're doing commencement speeches. Shut up! Sling Blade. We're doing commencement speeches all month long, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And a personal favorite of mine happened last year in New York City. NYU, New York University, that is. The Tisch School of Arts. And a guy that, well, is a legend, Robert De Niro. Born in New York City in Greenwich Village. Not a college boy. Spent a little time at the Actors Studio, but then just started acting and acting and acting. Two Oscars, Best Actor in Raging Bull, Best Supporting Actor is young Vito Corleone. 5-time Oscar nominee, Taxi Driver, Deer Hunter, Cape Fear, Awakenings, Silver Linings Playbook. And you can just go on and on. Midnight Run, classic comedy performance. Goodfellas, As Good As It Gets. Really?
Goodfellas.
So sorry. I know, Jersey. Not from Brooklyn. I'm not from Brooklyn. Jackie Brown, Casino, Heat, which is a favorite of mine. And, well, let's take a listen to what De Niro had to say. Let's listen to what he began with these enraptured graduates.
Tisch graduates, you made it. And you're think about that. The graduates from the College of Nursing, they all have jobs. The graduates from the College of Dentistry, fully employed. The Leonard N. Stern School of Business graduates, they're covered. The School of Medicine graduates, each one will get a job. The proud graduates of the NY School of Law, they're covered. And if they're not, who cares? They're lawyers. The English majors are not a factor. They'll be home writing their novels. Teachers, they'll all be working. Shitty jobs, lousy pay, yeah, but still working. The graduates in accounting, they all have jobs. Where does that leave you? Envious of those accountants? I doubt it. They had a choice. Maybe they were passionate about accounting, but I think it's more likely that they used reason and logic and common sense to reach for a career that could give them the expectation of success and stability. Reason, logic, common sense at the Tisch School of Arts? Are you kidding me? But you didn't have that choice, did you? You discovered a talent, developed an ambition, and recognized your passion. When you feel that, you can't fight it. You just go with it. When it comes to the arts, passion should always trump common sense. You aren't just following dreams, you're reaching for your destiny. You're a dancer, a singer, a choreographer, a musician, a filmmaker, a writer, a photographer, a director, a producer, an actor, an artist. Yeah, you're The good news is that that's not a bad place to start. Now that you've made your choice, or rather succumbed to it, your path is clear. Not easy, but clear. You have to keep working. It's that simple. You got through Tisch, that's a big deal. Or to put it another way, you got through Tisch, big deal.
Oh, it's and this is precious because De Niro is speaking the truth about the pursuit of the arts. And it's a wild game, and it's got to be about the passion trumping common sense, or you'd never do it. Let's rejoin De Niro giving the commencement speech again at NYU's Tisch School of the Arts in 2015.
On this day of triumphantly graduating, a new door is opening for you. A door to a lifetime of rejection. It's inevitable. It's what graduates call the real world. You'll experience it auditioning for a part or a place in a company. It'll happen to you when you're looking for backers for a project. You'll feel it when doors close on you while you're trying to get attention for something you've written and when you're looking for a directing or a choreography job. How do you cope with it? I hear that Valium and Vicodin work. I don't know. You can't be too relaxed and do what we do. And you don't want to block the pain too much. Without the pain, what will we talk about? Rejection might sting, but my feeling is that often it has very little to do with you. When you're auditioning or pitching, the director or producer or investor may just have something or someone different in mind. That's just how it is. That happened to me recently when I auditioned for the role of Martin Luther King in Selma. Which was too bad because I could have played the hell out of that part. I felt it was written for me. But the director had something different in mind. And you know, she was right. It seems the director is always right.
The director is always right, and he's right. In the arts and everywhere else, rejection is not personal. More often than not, it just feels personal.
It hurts.
And it hurts. But it isn't personal. De Niro talks about the rejection that those who have chosen this path in the arts, well, they experience it all the time. And how do you deal with it? How do you deal with this steady rejection?
By the way, there will be times when your best isn't good enough. There can be many reasons for this, but as long as you give your best, you'll be okay. Did you get straight A's in school? If so, good for you. Congratulations. But in the real world, you'll never get straight A's again. There are ups and there are downs. And what I want to say to you today is that it's okay. Instead of rocking caps and gowns today, I can see all of you graduating in custom TSOA T-shirts. On the back is printed, rejection. It isn't personal. And on the front, your motto, your mantra, your battle cry, next. You didn't get that part? That's my point. Next. You'll get the next one or the next one after that. You didn't get that waiter's job at the White Oak Tavern? Next. You'll get the next one or you'll get the next gig tending bar at Josie's. You didn't get into Juilliard? Next. You'll get into Yale or Tisch. You guys like that joke, so it's okay. No, of course, choosing Tisch is like choosing the arts. It isn't your first choice. It's your only choice.
Next. By the way, Mike Krzyzewski has a saying, next play. Don't look back to the last one. Don't look to the play after the play. Next play. That's it. Here's the conclusion of Robert De Niro's great commencement speech.
I've worked for and with a lot of people who attended Tisch, including Marty Scorsese, class of 64. As you learn your craft together, you come to trust each other and depend on each other. This encourages taking creative risks because you all have that, the sense that you're in it together. It's no surprise that we often work with the same people over and over. I did 8 pictures with Marty and plan to do more. He did about 25 with his editor, Thelma Schoonmaker, who he met at Tisch when she worked on a student film in the summer of 63. Other directors, Cassavetes, Fellini, Hitchcock, came back to the same collaborators over and over, almost like a repertoire company. And now David O. Russell and Wes Anderson are continuing that tradition. Treasure the associations and friendships and working relationships with the people in your classes and your early work. You never know what might come from it. There could be a major creative shift or a small detail that can make a major impression. Friendships, good working relationships, collaboration, you just never know what's going to happen when you get together with your creative friends. Marty Scorsese was here last year speaking to the 2014 graduates. And now here I am, here we are, on Friday at a kind of supersized version of one of Allison's student lounge hangout sessions. You're here to pause and celebrate your accomplishments so far as you move on to a rich and challenging future. And me, I'm here to hand out my pictures and resumes to the directing and producing graduates. I'm excited and honored to be in a room full of young creators who make me hopeful about the future of the performing and media arts. I know you're going to make it, all of you. Break a leg. Next. Thank you.
It does not get better than that. Robert De Niro speaking to NYU here on Our American Stories. He's speaking to all of you. Share it with your kids. Share it with anyone you know getting into the creative arts. Prepare them for a life of rejection. Actually, as my teacher used to tell me, develop an appetite for rejection. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. We'll be right back.
Jones babies in the first row. And my heart beats so that I can hardly speak. And I seem to find the happiness I seek. When we're out together dancing,
this is Lee Habib. You're listening to Lady Gaga.
I'm in heaven.
And she is singing with Tony Bennett live. And what an improbable pair. And we're about to talk about the improbable life of Irving Berlin for the last half hour of tonight's show. And how one immigrant came to write so many of America's greatest anthems. Berlin did it without anyone's help and without any formal music education. The man wrote God Bless America in 1918 while serving in the Army, but it didn't lead to anything. He set it aside for 20 years and returned to it only in 1938 after Hitler rose to power. Kate Smith recorded it. The rest was history. The song became America's unofficial national anthem, along with America the Beautiful. That would have been enough success for any music mortal, but this man was writing for the ages. He also went on to write one of the most popular songs of all time, White Christmas. And here's the most remarkable part of this man's story, Irving Berlin. The man who gave us God Bless America was not born in America. He was born in Russia. The man who gave us White Christmas was not a Christian. He was a Jew. Only in America. If you made his life story into a movie, critics would say it was ridiculous. It is that American. Berlin came to America like so many before him, seeking refuge from religious persecution. He was born Israel Berlin on May 11, 1888, one of eight children born near Mogilev in what is now the Republic of Belarus. His father, a cantor in a synagogue, uprooted his family after their village was destroyed in a violent anti-Semitic pogrom. His family settled in New York City in 1893, and according to his biographer Lawrence Berggren, as an adult, Berlin admitted to no memories of his first 5 years in Russia, except for one. His father, quote, lying on a blanket by the side of the road, watching his house burn to the ground. By daylight, the house was in ashes. That was not the last tragedy to befall this young man. His early life had more sad stories than the Old Testament. None worse than the loss of his father when he was merely 8 years old. While few other options were available, the young man took to the streets of New York to help support his family. To say those streets were tough would be an understatement. A poverty the likes of which poor people in America today would not even recognize gripped the Lower East Side of Manhattan, where young Irving lived. Rudyard Kipling, the great British writer, thought it was the worst poverty he'd ever seen, worse than the slums of Bombay. The poverty he witnessed when he visited the tenements of the Lower East Side. But he was impressed by the Jewish families in particular, noting the young immigrant boy saluting the stars and stripes. Kipling wrote, quote, "For these immigrant Jews are a race that survives and thrives against all odds and all flags," which proves the point that is often lost on us today. You can have very little in material wealth, but still not be poor. By the time he was 20, Berlin had stumbled by accident upon his life's work. He took a job as a waiter in Chinatown, where he discovered that his tips skyrocketed when he hummed various songs of the day. Singing cover tunes a cappella at dinner tables soon turned into a stint at songwriting. He collaborated with friends at first and soon got his first break as a staff writer with a music publishing house in New York City. His meteoric rise as a songwriter in Tin Pan Alley and then on Broadway started in 1911 with Alexander Ragtime Band's, which would become a hit by many artists, including Bessie Smith, Louis Armstrong, Bing Crosby, and of course, Ella Fitzgerald.
Come on in here, come on in here, and
Alexander's ragtime band. Come on in here, come on in here. It's the best band in the land. They can play a bugle call like you never heard before. So natural that you wanna go to war. That's just the best band. What am, oh, my honey lamb. Come on along, come on along. Let me take you by the hand. Up to the man, up to the man.
But ragtime music was not where Berlin's heart was. He wanted to create his own version of American music, one that embraced and appealed to the diversity and richness of his adopted nation, so that his music would be accessible to as many Americans as possible. He described his aspirations, quote, "My ambition is to reach the heart of the average American, not the highbrow nor the lowbrow, but that vast intermediate crew which is the real soul of the country. The highbrow is likely to be superficial, overtrained, and supersensitive. The lowbrow is warped and subnormal. My public is the real people." Berlin made good on that mission, creating the richest catalog of popular music by any songwriter in American history. It has been said that writing a song is a bit like giving birth, laborious and miraculous. Berlin gave birth to over 1,500 songs. He credited his productivity to an inborn work ethic. Sol Bornstein, Berlin's publishing manager, observed that, quote, "It was a ritual for Irving to write a complete song, words and music, every day. He told anyone who would listen that he, quote, did not believe in inspiration," end quote. His most successful compositions were the result of work. Berlin said once, "I do most of my work under pressure. When I have a song to write, I go home at night, and after dinner, about 8, I begin to work. Sometimes I keep at it until 4 or 5 in the morning. I do most of my writing at night." This he would do after a long day working on rehearsals for plays already in production. Few men write so many songs, let alone so many standards. Fewer still write songs that become a part of our national identity. And we're about to play some of those. The first, and what's remarkable about these songs, is the range of artists that cover them. This is the great Patsy Cline, a country and western artist, singing the classic Berlin song, Always. Fred Astaire performed a remarkable cover of Putting on the Ritz.
Have you seen the well-to-do up and down Park Avenue on that famous thoroughfare with their noses in the air? High hats and arrow collars, white spats and lots of dollars, spending every dime for a wonderful time. Now if you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits, putting on the Ritz.
And of course, when you hear Fred Astaire, you instantly think of Taco's version.
Where Rockefellers walk with sticks or umbrellas in the mix, putting on the Ritz. Have you seen the well-to-do?
Well, maybe not. I don't know that we're all really clamoring for more Taco, but we're going to go out with Taco singing Irving Berlin, because that's the range of this man's music. And as always, this is brought to you by the great people at Hillsdale College. Go to hillsdale.edu to see their great online courses and learn all the things that matter in life, from the arts to religion to political philosophy. It's all there. And again, this day in history, Irving Berlin was born, and always this day in history, brought to you here on Our American Stories by Hillsdale College.
Trying hard to look like Gary Cooper. Come, let's mix where Rockefellers walk with sticks or umbrellas in the mix.
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits? Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes or cutaway coat, perfect fits.
This is Lee Habib, and we're talking about the improbable life of Irving Berlin and the improbable use of Irving Berlin music in Young Frankenstein. A terrific scene. So we were talking about so many of these incredible standards that Irving Berlin wrote. We wanted to play just a few more for them and all the artists across the generations that interpreted these great songs. Here's the great Frank Sinatra singing How Deep Is the Ocean.
How much do I love you? I'll tell you no lie. How deep is the ocean? How high is the sky? How many times a day do I think of you? How many roses are spring?
You almost can't stop playing that song once it starts. Let's move forward to Diana Krall and her version of Let's Face the Music and Dance.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's music and moonlight and love and romance, let's face the music and dance.
Berlin did all of this without formal musical training. He could not read or write music, and taught himself to play piano. He played almost entirely in the key of F sharp because, as with so many self-taught musicians, it was easier for his untrained fingers to play the elevated and well-spaced black keys without hitting any wrong or white keys by accident. Quote, "The black keys are right under there under your fingers," Berlin would tell people unabashedly. "The key of C is for people who study music." Indeed, Berlin often boasted of his ignorance of music and claimed that it gave him a competitive advantage. Because he didn't know the rules of songwriting, he explained, he was, quote, free to violate them. Bing Crosby's version of White Christmas, well, it sold over 50 million copies. And that's an astounding number. And it's an astounding story. A poor, fatherless Jewish immigrant from Russia writes America's most beloved Christmas song. That's a story the ACLU couldn't wrap its mind around. Let's hear from Bing.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow. I'm dreaming.
And then it was on to that other anthem, Kate Smith introduced America to God Bless America on her radio show on Armistice Day in 1938, and we have her introduction to that song right here.
It's going to be my great, very great privilege to sing for you a song that's never been sung before by anybody. One that was written especially for me by one of the greatest composers in the music field today. It's something more than a song. I feel it's one of the most beautiful compositions that was ever written. A song that will never die. The author, Mr. Irving Berlin, the title, God bless America.
Well, there was the introduction, and boy, was Kate right. The song was originally written in the form of a prayer by Berlin, one seeking God's blessing and peace for this country. Over the years, the beautiful opening verse has been scrapped by most singers and by most schools, though one singer who always includes it is the great Irish singer Ronan Tynan. Here are the words that open the song. While the storm clouds gather far across the sea, let us swear allegiance to a land that's free. Let us all be grateful for a land so fair as we raise our voices in this solemn prayer. Swear allegiance, a land so fair, solemn prayer. No wonder we don't hear that verse much anymore. Let's hear Ronan Tynan's version.
While the storm clouds gather far across the sea, let us swear allegiance to a land that's free. Let us all be grateful for a land so fair as we raise our voices in a solemn prayer. God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with a light from above. From the mountains to the prairies to the oceans white with foam, God bless America, my home sweet home. God bless America, my home sweet home.
What a great place to hear that song in a hockey arena like Madison Square Garden. Berlin's music transcended multiple generations and religions, races, ethnicities, too. It transcended musical styles and time. Blue Skies, for instance, reached the top of the charts when it was written in 1927. It made its way back to the charts in 1978 when Willie Nelson covered it. Berlin wrote direct musical poems aimed straight at the heart. In the 1946 musical Annie Get Your Gun, Annie Oakley laments falling in love with Frank Butler in the Berlin gem I Got Lost in His Arms. And she says, well, let's hear Tony Bennett sing the beginning of this song.
I got lost in her arms, and I had to stay. It was dark in her arms, and I lost my way. From the dark came a voice, and it seemed to say, there you go.
The words. And of course, Bennett was just switching genders here. I got lost in her arms and I had to stay. It was dark in her arms and I lost my way. From the dark came a voice and it seemed to say, there you go, there you go. How I felt as I fell, I just can't recall. But her arms held me fast. It broke the fall. And I said to my heart, as it foolishly kept jumping all around, I got lost. But look what I found. America got lost in Irving Berlin's music. And from the dark, we can still hear that voice soothing us. Irving Berlin kept to himself, and made few public appearances during the last decade of his life, except for a very rare appearance to mark his 100th birthday at Carnegie Hall. If you ever get a chance, just put in Frank Sinatra, Carnegie Hall, Berlin in 100. And my goodness, wait till you hear what Frank does for Irving. He died 1 year later from natural causes at the age of 101. The improbable life of Irving Berlin, the man who gave us White Christmas, God Bless America. Here on Our American Stories, this is Lee Habib and Let's Go Out with Tony Bennett, and I Got Lost in Her Arms.
I can't recall, but her arms held me fast, and it broke the fall. And I said to my heart, as it foolishly kept jumping all around, I got lost. But look what I